morning. We welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room. And we have a special welcome for students from Monticello High School. Would they please stand?
Big group.
Well, that's quite a number of you. My count says 40. So thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. Students are invited to attend an oral argument. If the school and students agree to come, they come to the oral argument. They will meet after the second oral argument with a justice assigned for that day to meet with the students and discuss the procedures that the court uses to take and decide cases. They do not discuss the substantive issues of the case involved. And everyone is invited to join the students for that discussion. I was originally assigned to make the presentation with the students, but I have another meeting that has been scheduled, and so my colleague to the right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, will be the justice who will meet with the students from the high school here this morning, and they will be joined by students from Mount Horeb High School. So let me introduce the rest of the court to you. Starting on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, as I told you. The justice to my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is Justice
David Washington.
I do that all the time. Or at least
you look
one-third. It's Prosser, Justice David. And us on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Fortunately, these kinds of errors do not shake me for the rest of the day, so we will proceed. Before we do, does anyone here want a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you do, raise your hand, and the marshal will give you a summary. We have one taker, Marshal. Let me call the first case with those preliminaries made and done. American Transmission, we heard yesterday as the first case. Thank you, sorry. The first case today is 12-AP-500, Dane County versus Sheila W. And arguing on behalf of Sheila W. is Assistant State Public Defender Shelley Feit. Ms. Feit?
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Shelley Feit, and I represent Sheila W. Underneath the legal arguments in this case is a basic question. If and when Sheila and her family are taken to court again for refusing blood transfusions that are abhorrent to their religious faith, what will be the standard? What is the relevance of Sheila's own wishes and her own beliefs? Last year, when the Dane County Circuit Court was faced with these questions, it made its best guess. And it employed a simple standard. Sheila's beliefs and wishes were entirely irrelevant. The wishes of any patient regarding medical treatment are irrelevant until their 18th birthday, at which point they become nearly sacrosanct. regardless of competence, intelligence, or maturity, regardless of the treatment at issue, or apparently the reasons for refusing treatment or anything else. The court found that medical treatment for minors is a matter exclusively for the parents. And because the law is clear that parents cannot refuse potentially life-saving treatment on their children's behalf, an order subjecting Sheila to blood transfusions, which she likens to rape, was a foregone conclusion. Now the county wants this court to adopt the circuit court's bright-line rule as the common law of this state. It thinks a trial court facing a case like this one should ignore the patient sitting right in front of it, regardless of whether the patient is 14 years old or 16 or 17 and 364 days old, regardless of whether she completely understands her condition, and even if she is more mature and more intelligent than many of the adults who have contact with our court system. No.
Right. How old was Sheila at the time of the court hearing?
At the time of the court hearing, she was 15 and I believe around 8 months old. Her birthday is in June. The court hearing was in March.
Thank you.
Now, in Wisconsin, is there a general statute that says when you reach the age of 18, you are considered an adult?
No, there's not. There is in the construction of statutes section of the statute. There's, of course, the definition of adult and the definition of minor, which are consistent with the Children's Code and the Juvenile Justice Code, defining those terms as they are used in the statutes. But the statutes do not create an age of medical consent at 18.
Oh, if I want to know how old you have to be to vote, I'd have to go to a voting statute to find out that you can vote when you're 18.
Correct. There are all sorts of statutes setting the ages.
I want to know how old you have to be to get a driver's license or a driver's permit. I'd go to the automobile statutes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if I want to know about health procedures, there are some statutes that say a child can, that is somebody under 18, can give permission. Aren't there?
That is correct.
Everything is statutory and everything is age-focused.
Right. There are some particular statutes that that deal with medical consent for minors, but they're in very specific situations like mental health treatment, STD treatment, abortion. There's no generally applicable statute regarding minors.
What are you proposing? And you're not happy with what the circuit court did, is that right?
That's correct.
Why not? What did they do, and why aren't you happy?
The circuit court said it essentially adopted a bright-line rule that until you are 18, you have no role in your own medical care. So it's a matter exclusively for parents what happens with the medical treatment of minors. As far as I can tell, it was primarily basing this on the comments of the doctor, that that's the policy of the hospital, that until the child is 18. There is certainly no case law, there is no statute specifically stating that until a minor is 18, they would have no role in that. Every appellate court that has actually looked at this question in a state that doesn't have a statute on point has adopted the mature minor doctrine, which says that facts do matter. The intelligence and the competence of the patient matter. And all of the surrounding circumstances of the treatment and all of the interests that are at stake in the decision matter.
Counselor, doesn't if the court were to accept your argument and adopt the mature minor doctrine, doesn't that push a very significant decision on a child when it is usually the parent's obligation to care for the child? So it lets the parent escape their normal obligations to the care and welfare of their child by saying, oh, well, the child is mature. Decide if the child is mature enough to say no. That troubles me.
Ordinarily, it is the parent's role to make those decisions for their child. And in this case, really what we're talking about is specifically treatment that could potentially be life-saving or life-sustaining. So for the most part, this is going to be limited to that. But in that sort of case, what we're looking at is a standard where the court would first have to find that the patient has the competence and the maturity of an adult. So where you have a finding, a factual finding based on everything in front of the court, and that's, of course, the burden is on the minor to show that. And once you've found that, then that minor has their own personal interest in bodily integrity, in autonomy. So it's not, you know, letting the parents off the hook. It's recognizing the interests of that patient who is now old enough, mature enough, and competent enough to make the decision
Counsel,
for themselves.
You talk about every appellate court, and then you also, in response to Justice Rogensack's question, referenced it's limited or can be limited to treatment that is life-saving. I want to take a look at page 18, as I have, of your brief, to look at the cases, the appellate court cases that you cite as embracing your position. And those, I think, nine or so cases that you cite, when I look at them, save for one, which is an informed consent and not mature minor doctrine, because it dealt with a three-year-old, that's that first one, the COSEP case that you cite on page 18, every single one of them that referenced an age was 17 years old, between 17 and 18 years old. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct with the appellate cases here, and certainly none of the cases limited it to 17-year-olds. And the circuit court's bright-line rule that it created here and that the county is advocating for would not allow 17-year-olds to have any say. And then
the appellate cases that you've cited, I mean, for instance, the second one, the Belker case, that was 17 years, 8 months. The next one, Swan, that you cited, 17 years, 4 months. The next one, of course, EG, that we'll probably be talking about, is 17 years, 6 months. That's the case from Illinois. And also a number of those had relatively minor issues, unlike limited
minor health issues.
Minor health issues, thank you, rather than limited to treatment that is life-saving. For instance, the Bechtel case was a relatively minor, matter with minimal risk of injury. The Yontz case that you cite was an injured finger. The Backer case that you cite was, they said, a not very dangerous tumor on the ear. Another case that you cite dealt with having a vaccination. So aren't those cases arguably distinguishable based on age and the nature of the health issue involved?
Are they potentially distinguishable? Yes. This is a doctrine that's been developed since the early 20th century through today. Those early cases primarily came up in tort cases, and the reason I wanted to specify before that in general I'm going to be talking about where we're talking about life-sustaining, life-saving care is because the standards that they set up were a little bit looser in talking about a tort case because they were really looking at the reasonableness of a medical provider's decision to provide care to these patients. But as the doctrine has developed and as the years have gone on, and I think it was either Cruzan or Glucksberg where the United States Supreme Court recognized that these refusal of care cases are becoming more important as our medical treatment becomes better and better because there are lots of conditions that didn't used to be able to be treated that now can, and that sort of thing. As the doctrine has developed, it's increasingly dealt with refusal of consent cases with more serious sort of things. And then the most relevant case to this case to date is, of course, EG. out of Illinois, which is an incredibly similar case.
Counsel, could I ask you, are you familiar at all with the Newman case that was argued earlier this year to this court?
I'm sure I'm not as familiar as this court is, but I know the case you're talking about.
What, if any, interplay do you think there is between these issues we're deciding today and the Newman case? Or do you think they are so separate and so distinct that they have no impact on each other?
I don't think they have any impact on each other. My understanding of the Newman case is that we're talking about a fairly young child, and so certainly the mature minor doctrine in that case would have no applicability.
The legislature has spoken at least in the physical abuse of a child statute, 948.03, and it set forth treatment through prayer as a defense to physical abuse of a child, right? So there are times when the legislature says, here, these religious beliefs are something you ought to take into consideration when deciding this statutory issue. So to that extent, do you think there's any room for the legislature to be the one that takes action, or do you think this is just a common law doctrine that courts should adopt, and this court in particular should adopt, regardless of the fact that our legislature in particular has spoken on religious issues and when that becomes a defense or a consideration?
Sure. I mean, the legislature has indicated in various statutes that religious beliefs matter, as we've discussed in our briefs, that, you know, the differing age and maturity of people matter in terms of the rights and the abilities they get. I certainly don't have any problem whatsoever with the legislature reaching this question. The problem is that these cases are coming into circuit courts right now. I doubt they're coming in every day. But where you have a dispute, where you have a refusal of a significant medical treatment, the providers are necessarily going to be turning eventually to the courts.
Can a mature minor do a health care power of attorney?
Under the statute? Are you talking about, like, the advance of the power of attorney?
Right.
No,
to say, don't resuscitate or don't treat for this. I mean, is there any room? I'm not sure what the answer is. It's not like I'm asking you a trick question. I'm wondering if you know. You know, because healthcare powers of attorney do exist in the law. I'm just wondering, has the legislature created any room for minors to do that?
No, I believe those are specific to persons over 18, and that's because the parent is generally the person who is assumed to be to hold that power with the child, so there was no need for that. But to go back to...
Well, let me just follow up on that. If the legislature passed a law regarding the age of maturity for health care decisions, does the legislature have that power, in your opinion?
Certainly that would end the common law argument of adoption of the mature minor doctrine.
Right.
The constitutional issue would certainly still be there and would be raised.
What's the constitutional issue that you think will still be there?
The constitutional issue is the right to refuse treatment, which is a substantive due process right.
Of the child?
Of the patient, of the minor, yes.
All right. But so if the legislature passes a law that says if you're 16 and the trial court finds that you're mature, then you can determine your own health care provisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's within the legislative power, right?
Certainly, yes.
Okay.
The legislature could.
Is it exclusively legislative, or do you think the court has power to make that kind of rule?
Like
the rule the court says, no more immunity unless the governmental immunity unless the legislature says so.
The court absolutely has the power to act.
How do you know? How do you know that?
Well, the court has the power to act on all matters that are not covered by legislation. And again, these issues are coming before the court. And it is to say that, you know, nobody under 18 can have any role in their medical care, that's a common law rule right now. Whether you adopt the county's argument or whether you adopt Sheila's argument, you are adopting common law because there is no legislative rule in this state, and these cases are coming before the court. And so the question is, what is the standard the courts will apply?
Well, but in Eberhardy, for example, the court said, we have the power to determine whether there will be the operation in that case, which was sterilize, as I remember it. Thank you. But we're not going to exercise it, right? What do you think of that case applied to this case?
Well, I think the two biggest distinctions are, again, these cases are coming before the court, and they will keep coming before the court. As long as there is a refusal of care, as long as the law is that a parent cannot refuse potentially life-saving care for their child, these cases are necessarily going to the circuit courts. And without this court's guidance, they are left to decide the standard. And so it is essentially a matter of common law, regardless of what this court chooses to do with the case today. In Eberhardy, we were talking about parents who were trying to affirmatively have an order for sterilization. So this court could simply say, hey, circuit courts, don't act. Don't do anything. In this case, that's not really a possibility. And then, of course, the other thing that's addressed in the brief is that in Eberhardy versus this case, it's in Eberhardy, the court was deciding a rule that was protective of the individual rights of the patient in that case. In this case, certainly if the courts operate on an assumption, kids can't make medical decisions, I'm just going to assume there's a bright line rule at 18, then by leaving it to the legislature, you're actually setting it up so that courts are more restrictive of individual rights.
Well, what kind of rule do you think the court should set up? First of all, would you limit it to only life-saving issues rather than can I get my ears pierced, which the teenager might think is life-saving, but which others might not? So you're going to limit it to life-saving. Are you going to limit it to age? I thought when I read this, and I may not be remembering it correctly, that Virginia has an age of 15, right? Is that my right?
I believe that's true.
Yeah. So if are you going to limit it to life saving or something between ear piercing and life saving? Are you going to limit it to age, or are you just going to limit it to maturity, unlimited by age? I mean, I know people who are 10 who seem quite mature to me, and I've never asked them to make life-saving decisions, but maybe I have found them to be more mature in making everyday decisions than people who are 52. So, I mean, age is not necessarily the only criteria. Would your rule that you want this court to adopt be a rule that has an age limitation or just a maturity kind of limitation?
Well, let me address your first question first. You asked if I wanted to limit it to life-saving. And no, I guess I need to be clear here. What I'm talking about is cases that are coming before the courts. And what is the standard for those cases? Just practically, right, those cases are the life-saving sort of cases. Now, I mean, you'll see from the other mature minor doctrine, this comes up in plenty of other situations, and it's not a doctrine that's limited to life-saving situations. It's simply that in the ear-piercing scenario, that's not going to get to the courts. I don't even know how it could get to the courts. It wouldn't be getting resolved in the courts. This could have relevance for, you know, completely different areas of law, but I don't think the decision in this case would be addressing tort liability or things like that because, you know, the common law develops as cases come, and it simply wouldn't make sense to try to cover every single base you could here. In terms of limiting the age, the mature minor doctrine is appealing because it is not arbitrary. It's based on maturity. It's based on intelligence. Do I think a 10-year-old is ever going to be found mature an intelligence to the level of an adult, which is what we're talking about under the EG decision, where we're talking about life-sustaining care, I can't fathom it. But I don't think there's any need for this court to set a rule like that. I think that the circuit courts are more than capable of making determinations about competence, about maturity, and then also doing the balancing test where they look at the interests of the minor. If the minor has been found to have the maturity and intelligence of an adult, the interest that they have in refusing care, and balance those against other interests, the circuit courts are more than capable of doing that without some sort of bright line specific age limitation.
Did the parents have any legal duty on the facts of this case?
What do you mean in terms of, do they have a legal duty?
Toward Sheila.
I mean, certainly, yes. All parents have a legal duty. And, you know, this court has made clear that, as I said, a parent cannot refuse care for their child. But where the case is going to court because there is a refusal and the minor patient is seeking to make that decision for themselves, then the parent's role in the case can become potentially a little bit different because we're really talking about the parent's interests at that point. But, I mean, parents have a continuing duty for their children in all matters of their care.
Well, we talked about the health care power of attorney. And the age is 18, and I think that you said that the age is 18 because the responsibility is put upon the parent. You seem to be wanting to take the responsibility away from the parent.
It's not about taking the responsibility away from the parent. It's about recognizing the interests and the rights of the patient, him or herself. And the parents have a role in any sort of mature minor hearing because they, of course, have a very strong interest in the care that their child will receive. And without this finding, without this mature minor doctrine finding, there's no question. It's for the most part, it's the parents that are making these decisions. Although I don't doubt that doctors do allow adolescents to make some routine health care decisions without their parents.
No.
Could there be a conflict between the desire of the a minor and the parents?
Okay. Yes, certainly there could be.
Can a mature minor, in your view, reject what the parents desire?
They could, and this is a situation where the balancing test becomes incredibly important. If the parent is, if we're talking about a refusal and a minor who wishes to refuse, a parent who doesn't wish to refuse treatment, in a case that gets to court, which is, you know, just practically going to be pretty serious medical treatment, if the minor is found to have the maturity and intelligence of an adult such that their interest needs to be recognized by the court then has to look at the interests of the parent, which is incredibly strong here. They have an interest in the care, custody, and control of their child that's protected by the Constitution and that's protected by the common law. And then, of course, the state has always had an interest here, the state's interest in preserving life. And then if the parent is disagreeing, you even have a new state interest coming around in the preservation and protection of the family unit. And so there's no cases saying that there's a per se rule that if the parent disagrees, it would defeat the child, or the parent has an absolute veto. At the same time, if we're talking about potentially life-saving care, I do have a hard time imagining a balancing test coming out in a minor's favor where the parent and the state are aligned with strong interests that are in conflict with the minor's. But that's not this case.
Just want to emphasize what you said. The parents, if I understood you, have a constitutional right, a liberty right, over their children that's protected by the Constitution. They can make decisions for their children.
Correct. Yeah.
They also have an obligation to take care of their children. And that's where the state comes in. The state also has an obligation to take care and protect minors. That's your balancing test, isn't it?
Right. That's the balancing test. And it's, you know, I see that my time is up and I haven't talked about the constitutional right, but I'll just say it's effectively identical in terms of the common law and the constitutional balancing test that would have to be conducted here.
And it's the right of the liberty interest of the parent to take care of the child.
Right. So where you have a mature and competent child, you would have two liberty interests exactly. To play with the patients and the parents.
What if you had one parent who was a Jehovah's Witness and another parent who was not? And they didn't agree. And the child, say, was a Jehovah's Witness. What do we do there?
I think, again, the court would apply the same principles I've just talked about. They would have to balance the interests involved, and I think that would be a difficult case. But I think the parents' interest would be incredibly strong in that case.
You had a child that was 3 years old under the circumstances that whatever your name is has said that you'd have a balance of the father's constitutional right, the mother's constitutional right, and the state's obligation to protect the child.
Right, right. So here you have another interest involved if it's somebody with the maturity and intelligence of an adult. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Eve M. Dorman, Attorney Dorman, Dane County Corporation Counsel, representing Dane County. Ms. Dorman.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eve Dorman. I'm Assistant Corporation Counsel for Dane County. I've been assigned to this case since it came in initially as an investigation with the Dane County Department of Human Services. May it please the Court. Dane County asks that you dismiss this appeal as moot. The county believes that that's the most appropriate outcome in this case, one which leaves the delicate social balancing that we've been talking about among complex and competing policy interests to the legislature, a body inherently more equipped to craft a responsible solution in the face of what I believe is important psychological and neurobiological information that has not been addressed by Sheila W. Sheila W. argues that if you do not act, it will leave medical providers and courts unsure about what to do in these kinds of cases, and she references that these cases keep coming before the court. She offers in support of that in her reply brief an offhand comment by the trial judge in this case saying that it's not the first time he's wrestled with these issues. But I think that suggests that these cases are being resolved by the trial courts who seem quite clear about what to do. This judge certainly treated this as a simple, if not easy, question, indicating that Sheila was a 15-year-old kid and this is a decision that is remanded to the parents.
What if she was 17?
I'm sorry, Judge?
What if she was 17 years old, 9 months?
And
what would the judge have done?
I think this trial judge would have similarly indicated that because she was not yet 18, under the law of Prince and some of the constitutional law indicating the state's right to intervene to protect minors' health and safety, that he would have made the same decision, that the state's interest in a child outweighs the parents' interest in practicing their religion. I believe that he appropriately relied on the existing case law, the common law rule of the age of majority. Consent for medical treatment has, as Sheila W. recognizes, that common law rule has been that you have to be of the age of majority to consent to medical treatment, and that age in Wisconsin is 18.
Does Dane County think that what the trial judges should be doing is saying anyone under 18... parents rule?
Not necessarily, but that's where, in response to Justice Prosser's question about the parents' legal duty, what happens when parents don't exercise that legal duty, CHIP's jurisdiction lies.
Right.
The language of 4813 sub 10 is where a parent neglects, refuses, or is unable to provide adequate supervision and care so as to create a serious risk of physical harm for a child, that parent is liable for neglect in the Wisconsin courts. And so
that includes medical care.
That does definitely include medical care.
In response to Justice Ziegler, and I'm sorry, I just cannot remember that statute. Some of the statutes in CHIPS say you can't use religion to find a CHIPS case.
Correct. There is a provision in the statutes that indicate, for example, if parents refuse to vaccinate their children because of religious beliefs, that does not give rise to CHIPS liability.
But yes. The legislature took care of that.
Correct. And to my recollection, the vaccination arena is the only place in which they have specifically accepted parents from CHIPS liability for failing to provide recommended medical care.
Counsel, do you think that the Children's Code, Chapter 48, specifically 48257 and the related statutes, where it discusses a petition to initiate a procedure to waive parental consent to a minor's abortion, do you think that statutory section helps or hurts your argument? And I direct this to both counsel. The legislature specifically in there requires certain allegations to be made in that petition, including a statement that the minor is mature and well-informed enough. And this is when the minor wants to go to court to get a court's permission for an abortion because they don't get it through their parents. What, if any, impact do you think the legislature's choice in that language has on your argument today?
Well, I think it is an example of a case in which the legislature attempted to balance the interests that come before it. What I find interesting about the minor abortion statute is that it doesn't actually give the minor the right to consent to her own medical care. It gives the provider the right to proceed in the absence of parental consent. And if you note, the provider can proceed in the absence of parental consent in certain very specific circumstances, where the pregnancy is essentially the result of the child being a victim of a crime, where there's a sexual assault or sexual abuse by some adult, in cases where a mental health professional avers that the minor is likely to commit suicide in the event that they are not permitted to have an abortion, and by court review. Those initial circumstances under which a provider is authorized to proceed with a minor's abortion without parental consent seem to me, not about recognizing the maturity of a minor to make that decision, but about limiting the impact of the victimization of a crime and a child's mental health. This isn't about, they have the maturity to be able to make that decision. It's about protecting the pregnant minor. Now, the court review process, I am not sure that was developed in Wisconsin with an eye to determining how you're going to know if a minor is mature enough to make this kind of decision. As you know, the abortion litigation has come down to us from the federal courts, from the U.S. Supreme Court, from Roe, from subsequent cases beyond Roe, talking about ways in which states can restrict access to abortion. And I believe it's the Ohio case. I'm blanking on the name right now. But it specifically says that you can't limit a minor's access to abortion without some sort of court review process. And I would have to look at the legislative history of the abortion rights statute here, but the way it's worded makes me think that Wisconsin adopted that in response to the case law that says there has to be a judicial review process. So we put in a judicial review process. But it doesn't sound to me like they've given a lot of thought to how the court is supposed to make that determination that the minor is mature. It doesn't give any standard. If you look at the Bilotti versus Baird case cited by Sheila W., as well as the EG case that we've talked about, those cases have been criticized by commentators for failing to provide a specific standard for how the courts are supposed to determine that a minor is mature. And I think that continues to be the problem that we're wrestling with. What has concerned me and Dane County, as I have done the research for this brief, the readily available research that I cited to some of in my brief shows that there are factors about adolescent decision-making that no court has considered. when you talk about the factors that courts have previously relied on to determine maturity, they talk about age and experience and judgments and their understanding of their medical condition and their understanding of the risks, benefits, and alternatives of the medical condition. But the research that I cited shows that adolescents, while they may be perfectly capable of understanding factual information, they make decisions differently. Factors such as susceptibility to peer pressure, a need to feel normal in the face of a serious illness, a desire to please important adults around them, a desire for sensation-seeking, reward-seeking, all of those kinds of factors that make teens bad, particularly at snap judgments, but other judgments as well, those factors seem to peak in mid-adolescence right around the age of 15. The research that I cited is also clear that adolescents have less tolerance for illness and treatment and that they weigh value structures differently than adults. And what Sheila W. fails to account for, and what I believe that statute fails to account for, is the fact that the adolescent mind weighs risks and benefits differently, inherently differently, than an adult mind. And the teen pregnancy is the perfect example. I suspect that every one of these high school students sitting behind me today can tell you that having unprotected sex results in a significant risk of an unplanned pregnancy. But teens engage in unprotected sex and take that risk because they believe it isn't going to happen to me. It's just going to be this one time, and it isn't going to happen to me. And that's a clear example of a way in which a teen can understand the factual information presented to him or her and yet make a different decision than an older individual would make.
Well, here's my problem. I don't know exactly what Dane County wants us to do other than dismiss this as moot, okay? So suppose we're not going to dismiss it as moot. I want you to know what kind of opinion you think would be helpful to the trial judges, not only of Dane County, but of all counties, and to the people who come before you, which is both the parents or parent substitutes and the child and the doctor, right? And the state's interest in protecting both the constitutional right of the parent to take care of the child and make decisions for the child and the constitutional right of the child and the obligation of the state to protect. So what kind of rule should come out of this case? Now, I think I understand, that Sheila W. Wants the court to say it's up to the trial court to balance all these rights and interests and to give weight to a mature minor, whatever that means. I mean, that's what I understand, Sheila W. What's the county's position?
I'm going to answer your last question first.
Okay.
Sheila W. talks about this balancing test, that once a minor is determined to be mature, that the court then exercises this or engages in this process of balancing state interests and third-party interests and some other things. And my concern about that balancing test is that when it comes down to it, it doesn't really end up being a balance at all. The law seems pretty well settled that the state's interest in preserving life must always yield to a competent adult's right to refuse life-saving treatment. And it follows to me, then, that if a minor is determined to be mature, and as you say, whatever that means, that they are then afforded the same right to refuse treatment as a competent adult. And in those circumstances, the state's interest in preserving life must always yield to the competent adults and now mature minors' right to refuse medical treatment. On the flip side, Sheila W. argues that if you don't afford a minor an opportunity to show that she is mature, the state's interest will always prevail. And I can see that side as well. But it seems to me that in a state with a history of preserving life, as I noted in my brief, that this state has a much stronger interest in its children's lives than it does in the lives of its adults. And I think that's appropriate. You know, we've held that that a patient has to be in a persistent vegetative state before life-sustaining treatment can be withdrawn. And I noted that counsel use life-sustaining and life-saving sort of together, but those are different. They're conceptually different. Life-sustaining treatment is treatment which merely postpones an inevitable death. Life-saving treatment is treatment which provides an opportunity, at least, for a cure and for recovery.
Yeah, but ultimately it's death anyway.
Ultimately, yes.
Well, there's a distinction there, but only in timing.
But I think that brings me back to my point that the way in which maturity is determined is the critical factor here, because once you determine that a minor is mature, that balance is skewed away from the state's interest in the preservation of life. So you ask what kind of a decision.
That's right. I want you to answer me.
You ask what kind of a decision I would like to see. Well, first of all, I would like this court to decline to adopt the mature minor doctrine. But assuming that you're going to go down that road, what I would like to see is some form of an age limit. I think 16 is appropriate. The reason I think 16 is appropriate is because the research shows that these sensation-seeking and susceptibility to peer pressure, that some of those factors that I talk about seem to peak between the ages of 12 and 15, and by the age of 16, they're dropping off again. Concurrently, the development of a rational system of thinking and decision-making develops steadily from the time a teen is about 12 until they're about 27, according to most of the research. So by the time you get to 16 or 17, you're sort of reaching that place where the sensation-seeking is dropping off and the rationality is steadily increasing. So I think that gives us a better chance of having a minor, a child, who can understand the information and not be susceptible to some of those other factors. What I would also ask is that this court set out specific criteria that the trial court has to consider in making that determination. And while I think the legislature is better suited to determine those criteria, because I certainly can't claim to be an expert in adolescent decisional capacity or adolescent neurobiology, I think at the very least the trial court should consider to what extent adults are influencing this child. In Sheila W.'s case, it was very interesting sitting in the hearings with her parents, with the seven elders from her church who sat in the back watching with interest every word of the proceeding. I don't know to what extent that serves as an incentive for Sheila, perhaps, that to be that one in her church that achieves this right for all of the members of her church in Wisconsin. Should that be an incentive? Is that what she would articulate? Probably absolutely not. But when you look at that 15-year-old sitting there with the seven elders of her church who have the power to disfellow her, I don't know that we sufficiently assess the potential impact that that dynamic had on Sheila. And so in your decision, I would ask that the court somehow assess the impact that outside influences are having on the child's decision-making. I would ask that the court make some inquiry into the level of impulsivity that a child continues to demonstrate. I would ask that the court look into the extent to which the fact that they are critically ill is affecting them. I would limit this to life-saving treatment, but even that, I think, is difficult because the line about life-saving treatment is complicated. I referenced in my brief, what about the kid who doesn't want surgery for critical appendicitis? What about the kid who doesn't want to take shots for allergies that have the potential to kill them? What about the kid who doesn't want treatment for a chronic skin infection that could result in gangrene? You know, I think there are all kinds of things that, if not treated, have the potential to be life-threatening. And so I think there's going to be some difficulty in defining that as well, but I certainly think it should be limited to life-saving treatment.
Could the court under, can a trial court, without any decision in this case, decide that that no transfusion be given to Sheila W. after looking at everything?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
the
last
part. Could the trial court have made a different decision in this case, namely that Sheila was understood what was happening, that the trial court is going to respect her wishes, the wishes of her parents who have constitutional rights, and therefore go against the guardian's recommendation and say no transfusion? Is that possible today without any decision from this court? Could the trial court have done that in this case?
I don't believe so under existing
law. Why not?
Because in Wisconsin, the Montalvo case and the Edna MF case read together indicate that you cannot withhold even life-sustaining treatment from someone unless they are in a persistent vegetative state, which Sheila clearly was not. Moreover, this was life-saving treatment. Additionally, I believe that under the constitutional line of cases asserting the state's interest in the lives and life and health of its children, I don't believe the trial court could have made that decision. Certainly, had it made that decision, there likely would have also been an appeal.
In other words, you believe that the present status of the law is that the trial court, in dealing with someone who has less than 18 years of age, the trial court must say that life-saving measures will be taken, you know, assuming that they are not outrageously harmful or dangerous or painful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I believe that it is the parent's responsibility to make that decision, and I believe that children's voices are heard through those of their parents. I don't know of a parent who would look at their 16-year-old and say, I'm going to make a decision for you regardless of what you say.
I used to do it all the time.
Certainly about some things. But I think the children's voices are assumed to be heard through their parents.
But assuming it's not a life-threatening cure or treatment, mm-hmm. Your position is that the circuit court must authorize and direct that that treatment be given the child when the child, 17 years and 5 months, and the parents don't want it.
What I think the court has the power to do is to do what this trial court did and appoint a guardian to consider what's in that child's best
interest.
That's
right. I'm asking if the trial court had the power.
Yep.
After the guardian made a decision made a recommendation, and everybody in this case didn't want it except the guardian, can the trial court say no transfusion? Or is the law in the state, in your opinion, such that the trial court had to order the transfusion because it was life-saving, and it had no side effects? I mean, it had religious side effects, but no medical side effects that were discernible.
Well, certainly there's always a risk of side effects with serious medical procedures, but yes, I believe the trial court...
That goes for vaccinations, too.
I believe the trial court was required under the current state of the law to ensure the life and health of this child.
That's what I'm asking.
And I believe that that's appropriate for this court to maintain as the law in Wisconsin, unless and until the legislature can come up with a credible construct under which we can reliably determine the maturity of a minor.
Is it your position that this court doesn't have the power to...
I think this court does have the power, okay. But I think your reference to the Everhardy case was right on target. I think this court has the power, but in the exercise of judicial restraint should not exercise it in recognition of the fact that there is information out there that we as lawyers, certainly, and potentially courts, trial courts throughout the state, either don't have the access to or don't have the time and the wherewithal to develop the expertise in adolescent decisional capacity to make reliable judgments about the maturity of the minors coming before them.
Counsel, I want to follow up on the Chief's question. Your position in writing an opinion, you've indicated, is, first of all, this, like the Court of Appeals did, we should dismiss it because it's moot. Secondly, I understand you do not want us to adopt a mature minor doctrine, but if we do, then you spoke to that. The question that I have is remand. What should we do? Should we remand this? If we would adopt a mature minor doctrine, what then? I note that the E.G. case in the Supreme Court of Illinois adopted a mature minor doctrine based on the common law, but said this case is moot and we're not going to remand. Mm-hmm. That's one alternative, I assume. But in reading your briefs, it seems to me that you're suggesting an additional alternative.
Well, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because contrary to Sheila W.'s reply brief, Dane County does object to remanding this matter for further proceedings. Dane County does object to remanding these matters for further proceedings. As you know, there was colloquially a CHIPS order entered for temporary physical custody, and then there was a guardianship order that was entered appointing a guardian with the authority to consent to medical treatment. Once the guardian was appointed, the minor was receiving the necessary medical care. There was no need to continue a CHIPS case, and that matter was dismissed prior to fact-finding, prior to disposition. So that case has been closed for approximately a year. The guardianship was a temporary guardianship, and I apologize, I didn't refresh my recollection about the specific terms of it, but it was a temporary guardianship under Section 5450 of the statutes. I believe it was ordered to be in place for 60 days with a potential for an extension of an additional period of time. As a party to that action, I should have been noticed if it was extended. I was never noticed that there was any extension of it. To the best of my knowledge, that order expired by its terms. It would have been in early May of 2012. So both of the underlying proceedings have been closed for almost a year. By the time this court is able to render a decision, it will be presumably at least several weeks from now. I don't believe that there's any reason to remand this cause. If there comes a time when Sheila W. is being asked to participate in treatment necessary to save her life and she wishes to refuse, if by that time this court has announced a new rule of law in Wisconsin, she can initiate a new procedure and exercise her rights under whatever new rule this court has announced. But there is nothing in this record to suggest that this is an ongoing problem at this point. For the last year, there has not been, to the best of my knowledge, any movement to subject her to additional transfusions to which she objects. And to the best of my knowledge, she survives. And so if there does come a time when she where there's an adult pressure to be subjected to additional blood transfusions, and at that time there's a new rule of law, she can avail herself of that at that time. So I don't believe remand is appropriate here.
If we would remand, so I'm having you lose on everything.
Well, why should today be any different? Yeah.
If we would remand, what would be the issue on remand?
Well, according to Sheila W., the issue on remand would be the extent to which she is mature enough to make her own medical decisions. And if...
As of age 15 years, 8 months, or as of now,
well,
a year later?
I really think that with respect to her ability to make decisions at the age of 15 years and 8 months, that ship has sailed. She is now a year older. I think the research is also clear that maturity is a fluid concept, and it increases, presumably, over time. And so I don't think there's any way now to have a hearing that will clearly establish how mature she was at the age of 15 years and 8 months. I think you could potentially have a hearing on how mature is she now. And I think that's certainly a possibility, but I don't know how to turn back the clock to be able, in light of the factors that I've raised, how do you determine now how susceptible she was to influence then?
The mootness is a little difficult analytically. Mm-hmm. So what is the hook, if you will, since there's not a pending CHIPS or a pending guardianship? What is the legal authority for having a hearing on a case that doesn't exist?
I agree, Judge. I think that creates a tremendous difficulty in reopening proceedings. I mean, certainly if this court orders us to have a hearing, we'll have a hearing. But given that the cases are and have been closed for an extended period of time and that there is not an active controversy between the parties, I really struggle to see the utility of any remand at this point. I believe, you know, there can be a new action if necessary, but I'm, you know, no one has brought to the county's attention any need for further medical treatment resulting in a new action. So I don't believe that there is a basis to remand this matter. And as I told you at the beginning, I am asking that you dismiss the appeal as moot. You have me losing on every count, so that's why we're down this road. But I don't think that there's anything to be heard on remand. So. And I see that I'm almost to the end of my time. I did just want to note, going back to that, to the Eberhardy case, that that court engaged in a discussion about the utility of engaging in analyses, in that case, of best interest without some sort of a clarifying policy directive. In fact, the court noted that the vague, although frequently useful, best interest analysis appears to be inadequate unless there's an authoritative declaration of public policy to guide the exercise of that discretionary act. And that's 102 with second 539 at 568. And the court went on to note that even by taking judicial notice of medical treatises that talked about the efficacy and alternatives to what was then termed eugenic sterilization, that the courts really knew very little about those kinds of things. And the same could not be more true in this case. I believe courts know very little about adolescent decisional capacity. I don't really expect my trial judges around the state to be experts in adolescent neurobiology. I think requiring trial courts to make these determinations based on a concept that as poorly defined as maturity is at this point is pretty hazardous.
You know, judges and lawyers are going to have to argue neurobiology. I mean, this is one of the upcoming sciences. There are seminars all over the country about use of neurobiology, especially in criminal cases.
Yes.
Relating to one responsibility, which is not generally recognized in the law, as with diminished responsibility or diminished capacity. And yet in sentencing, that certainly is a consideration, and probably under evidence-based sentencing, the concept of neurobiology and what works and what doesn't work. If it isn't here already, it will be next week. It will come up in tort cases. Medical malpractice, it'll come up in a number of cases. It may, we just accept 18, you can contract. Well, maybe you don't have the capacity to contract, and maybe these fixed ages or voting or driving or whatever is all subject to potential neurobiology. So to argue that the courts know little and we shouldn't press it, they're going to be held to know a lot.
And I understand, Judge. And if you note in my brief, I referenced briefs that were filed by the American Psychological Association on this very issue, where the American Psychological Association was taken to task because in a case involving a minor's access to abortion, they argued that minors could be mature and could make these kinds of decisions. But in cases related to subjecting 16 and 17-year-olds to the death penalty for criminal acts, that they should not be held responsible for their actions. And I think the analysis in that is very telling and important, and it goes back to the discussion that I had about the difference between the socio-emotional sphere of adolescent development and the cognitive control, more rational development in adolescence, and how those two are not synchronous. They don't happen at exactly the same time or at exactly the same rate, and I think that's the key that this court is going to need to consider if you attempt to craft guidance for trial courts in making these determinations. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Feit.
I'll first address Justice Ziegler's question, because she had said that she'd like us both to be thinking about it, which is the role of the consent to abortion case, or sorry, the consent to abortion statute. And, you know, I think it's only marginally relevant. I think the biggest relevance is simply it actually takes away a minor right to consent. So it requires parental consent for abortion, except where constitutionally we have to let the minor do it. And the legislature appears to be operating under an assumption the minor could consent without the statute. And just a quick reading of the legislative history backs up that that is what the legislature was thinking at the time. Now, the county criticizes the courts that have looked at the mature minor doctrine as setting no standard. I don't think that the county really means setting no standard. I think they mean, you know, they're looking for a list of specific evidence, what exactly needs to come in at each one of these hearings. And I think it's important to note that in this kind of case, the presumption is on the minor to show capacity here. And to some extent, this has got to be left to the parties. There's absolutely nothing in Sheila's argument that would say anything the county's saying is irrelevant. In fact, I think it would be highly relevant. And the county or whatever the opposing party is in these sorts of hearings would be able to bring in whatever evidence they feel is appropriate. The minor would be able to bring in whatever evidence they feel is appropriate. And the judge could make a decision based on everything in front of him. And again, you know, like the chief was just mentioning, this is what courts are doing, and this is what they're going to have to do increasingly in the future. They listen to experts. In these cases, they're going to have to listen to the patients themselves. That's really going to be the most important testimony they're going to hear.
Counsel, for clarification, I want to make sure I understand. You are not advancing here before this court a free exercise constitutional argument. Is that correct? You are not advancing it?
I'm not advancing an independent free exercise. I think free exercise is relevant to the balancing test. I don't think I can make an argument there's an independent free exercise right here. I do think that if this court does not adopt the mature minor doctrine, again, one of the compelling things about the doctrine is it neutralizes constitutional claims like Sheila has here. And, you know, we haven't talked about the Constitution too much.
Let me talk about it briefly then. My recollection is that the Court of Appeals decision in Illinois in the EG case rested on the free exercise constitutional argument along with the Emancipation Statute. Am I correct?
So there are two cases that have basically looked at the constitutional issue, the Novak case, that federal trial case, and the EG Court of Appeals, not the Supreme Court case. I would say, I mean, they're sort of two sides of the same coin. Neither of them do a particularly thorough analysis, and I'll say that I couldn't quite get from the EG Court of Appeals decision what precisely they were resting on, because they do talk about the abortion cases, which are substantive due process cases. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's just a free exercise case. You know, I think those cases, it sort of shows that essentially no, you know, there are these two courts that have looked at it. They've come to opposite conclusions. I think you really have to go to the original cases, to the United States Supreme Court cases, where, you know, the only place where substantive due process rights have been looked at for minors is in abortion cases, and the right to refuse medical treatment is a substantive right, like the right to abortion. I think we can't just ignore those cases and say, oh, that's abortion, that's its own thing, you can't ever apply it outside of this context. And those cases look clearly to competence and maturity. And then you have to take those cases and look at them in conjunction with the right to refuse medical treatment cases with the balancing test. And it's really the only workable constitutional standard. You can't simply say, you know, he hasn't attained the voting age, no right, there's no case law, there's nothing that would suggest that's how you would analyze a constitutional issue like this. And that becomes a big issue in this case if the mature minor doctrine is rejected and ignored. And I guess I'll just deal with the remand really quickly since Justice Bradley had asked about that. This is a case in a very weird posture. At the same time, I mean, Sheila does have a medical condition that could create the same issue at some point in the future. And so that's why we're asking for a remand which this court certainly has the power to do, as the county said. I mean, if you tell them to hold a hearing, they'll hold a hearing. But I do want to be clear, if you decide that remand is inappropriate because of the specific posture of this case, this is not an academic matter for Sheila, and this is still important. And whatever this court says about the mature minor doctrine will be the standard that's applied if she has a hearing in the future and others like her. And by recognizing the mature minor doctrine, this court will provide that she will not simply be ignored in that sort of hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Ms. Veit and Ms. Dorman for their excellent briefs and their very elucidating arguments today on a very tough issue that does affect real-life people and real-life circumstances. That concludes our hearing in 12 AP 500 Dane County versus Sheila W. We will take a few moments of recess so that the high school students who are here will leave if they wish, and the Mount Horeb High School students can enter the court. We are in recess.
They expect me to screw up that way. As quickly as possible, please come in and find a seat.